8 o'clock. We're going to get started. I'll give you the quick review of the electromagnetic spectrum so you can wake up, I guess. I don't know. And we talked about the fact that the electromagnetic spectrum ranges from gamma rays, high energy, all the way down to radio waves on the low energy side. People talk about ELF. You know what ELF is? Extremely low frequency radiation. That's, you know, how they have the power lines that come overhead, and people worry about the cows grazing under the power lines, that if they hang out under the extremely low frequency radiation too long, they'll start to give chocolate milk or something. Anyway, yeah, they worry about cancer risk. Talking about low frequencies like the 60 hertz AC electricity that's running through the building. That's very low frequency. So that's way down on the low end of the frequency scale. So we have this spectrum of light. It's, you know, the sun gives off essentially all wavelengths of light, although there are dark spots in the spectrum of the sun, referred to as Fraunhofer lines. That's his chemical trivia. Okay, so we have this spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. As analytical chemists, all we care about is how can we use the radiation to measure things, to make chemical measurements, to understand matter and the interaction of light with matter. And so we have the spectrum laid out for us, but I also mentioned to you that we can do different types of spectroscopy. I mentioned nuclear transitions and the idea of doing gamma ray spectroscopy, which we do in the nuclear center. Sometimes the specific technique is neutron activation analysis, or instrumental neutron activation analysis, INAA. And I mentioned stick a sample in the reactor, bombard it with slow neutrons, create unstable nuclei, and then you can count that in a counting system. Has a detector that will respond to gamma radiation. You're now doing gamma ray spectroscopy. You need to separate the energies to know what it is that's giving rise to that particular energy of gamma radiation. That tells you what the substance is, because certain things give off certain energies, certain transitions occur. But these are nuclear transitions. It's a chromium 54 going to, you know, whatever. I've done so little of this that I'd have to go back and look up the particular transitions. But it's a nuclear transition. It's actually going from one form in the radioactive decay series to another form, and ultimately ending up as, you know, lead, some form of lead. So we'd be doing gamma ray spectroscopy, and we'd be dealing with very high energies, dangerous, right, to be exposed to this stuff. So you have to wear lead underwear when you go in there, okay, and to protect yourself from the radiation. We could do X-ray spectroscopy as well, and different kinds of X-ray spectroscopy. I mentioned a few. X-ray absorption and X-ray fluorescence are mentioned here. There's a lot of X-ray techniques. There's X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy. I mentioned that we have, I think, two instruments in the basement that will do X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy. You can do X-ray diffraction. That's not really... it's a form of spectroscopy, I guess. We're just looking at the diffracted X-ray. You could do Zanes. It's an X-ray fine structure technique. Okay, but these are all dealing with transitions that occur at the inner shell electrons, and it's generally destructive, right? You're going to rip an inner shell electron out of something, you're probably going to destroy it, and so you're going to do damage. And X-rays are damaging radiation. As we get further, so we got X-rays and gamma rays, and again, this gives you a feeling for frequency versus wavelength from the equation I gave you, the wavelength equation I gave you earlier on, a couple of classes ago. We have in our area that we're interested in, the ultraviolet region, we start to deal with outer shell electrons. And actually, in the visible region, okay, and the ultraviolet region, we deal with outer shell electrons. We promote the outer shell electron to some upper energy level, and we observe the absorption or the emission of light energy from those outer shell electrons, or as those outer shell electrons undergo an absorption or emission type transition. Pretty important for us in particular, but also in general for analytical chemistry. The visible region is split out here for you to show you the colors of the spectrum. And we're going to deal with the visible light from pretty much 400 or maybe 350, 300, 350 is typically the transition region between the UV and visible. And then we're going to go all the way up to the 700, 800 nanometer region of the spectrum, which is the red end of the spectrum, getting into the near IR. We'll deal with that to some extent. And I mentioned, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, or used to be indigo and violet that they referred to. Now they've sort of merged indigo and violet together. The ultraviolet region runs from maybe 200 nanometers, okay, down to the 350 that I mentioned, or in that neighborhood. And so that's an important region for us, and we're going to do things like UV visible absorption and fluorescence in this class. I'll mention other things, right? I already mentioned, you know, circular dichroism and optical rotatory dispersion and different techniques related to absorption and fluorescence, and using that same region of the spectrum, like scattering nephelometry, turbidimetry, things of that nature. We'll also talk, I'll mention fairly frequently the infrared region of the spectrum, and I'll talk about infrared spectroscopy because it's so closely related instrumentally, obviously region of the spectrum. We'll talk about FTIR very briefly, and we'll talk about interferometers and how they work in an FTIR instrument, those kinds of things. But if you take structural analysis, you'll learn more about how to deal with the spectra and what the different transitions refer to in terms of molecular vibrations and bending and wagging and all of that kind of stuff. We won't talk much about the microwave region of the spectrum, although we mention it here that you can do spectroscopy there. It's very boring. It doesn't give you a lot of information. And so it's very marginalized in terms of, I don't even know of anybody on this campus doing microwave absorption. There might be somebody in physics doing it, but it doesn't give you a lot of chemical information. Chemists don't use it very much, except when they pop popcorn. And then there are the absorptions due to spin states, whether we're talking electron spins or nuclear spins. And so nuclear spins is NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance. Electron spins, we're talking about EPR or ESR. Same technique. If I'm talking, the terminology turns out that if I'm talking about a free radical, right, a free radical having a unpaired electron, if I'm looking at the spin of that electron, or looking at that electron, you have to have, in order to do for a molecule to be ESR active, it has to have an unpaired electron. And so if I'm looking at the spin state of that electron, I'm in an organic molecule like a radical type species, I'm doing ESR, electron spin resonance. If I'm looking at a paramagnetic metal ion, okay, like a copper, which has two isotopes, one of which is paramagnetic, I believe, or certain iron, I think iron, vanadium, various paramagnetic ions, manganese. They'll all come to me eventually. Cobalt. Nickel, okay, species that have a free electron, have an unpaired electron, then we're doing electron paramagnetic spectroscopy, okay, EPR, okay, electron paramagnetic resonance. Same technique, it's just two different names. If you're an inorganic chemist, it's EPR. If you're an organic chemist, it's ESR. Use a big magnet, okay, put the sample in the magnet. We want to align the spins. We look at radiation in the gigahertz region, okay, radiation in the gigahertz frequency region that's absorbed to cause the flipping of the spins. In a case of ESR, EPR, it's a electron spin. In the case of NMR, we're using radio waves, and we're looking at nuclear spins. All right, so all different techniques, all useful. We already saw, based on Boltzmann's distribution, that we have, at any given temperature, we're going to have some species in the excited state, some in the ground state. If the energy gap is big, then we're probably not going to have a lot of them in the upper state, because it's going to take a lot of energy to get them up there at ambient temperatures. But if the energy gap is small at ambient temperature, room temperature, you may have quite a few in the excited state, in the upper state. And then we put radiation into the system, look at the absorption, cause the transition from the ground state to the excited state. Or we look at the emission that is released as the species goes from the excited state to the ground state. So that's the kind of things we're going to be doing in spectroscopy-wise. We ended with this slide last class, I believe, because we need to talk about the Beer-Lambert law, or Beer's law, in order to do quantitative spectroscopy. So the analytical chemist wants to do quantitative analysis. I want to measure something. I want to know how much of it there is, and maybe a little bit qualitatively about what it is. And so I'm going to use the Beer's law to determine quantitatively how much I have. It tells us that absorbance, A, is this parameter absorbance, which is defined as the log, base 10 logarithm of the source intensity, or it says here measured source intensity, I0, divided by the intensity of the light or the electromagnetic radiation after absorption. Okay. Interesting thing that if you change, because of the way absorbance is defined as a ratio, if you change the intensity, it doesn't really matter, because you're taking a ratio of the intensity of light from the source versus what's transmitted through the sample. So if my source is strong today and I measure that ratio, tomorrow, when my source may be dying, it's about to go out, the light's about to go out, okay, I'll still get the same ratio, even though the intensity may have changed. So so that's a good thing, right? So we've got this ratio measurement, and then that's equal to the molar absorptivity. Molar absorptivity is an intrinsic parameter about the species of interest, all right? So I've got a solution of something. Maybe I've the students do aspirin in the laboratory, acetylsalicylic acid, right? It's a benzene ring, you know, with a acetate group coming off of it and an OH group, a phenolic group off of it. And so they measure that, they put it into solution, and it absorbs maybe around 300 nanometers or so. And it has some intrinsic molar absorptivity. It absorbs a certain amount for every mole of the substance that you have. So this is a very important intrinsic parameter. B is the path length. Oh, C is the concentration. B is the path length. Okay. So B is the path length of the particular sample that you put in. So we all are familiar with our cuvettes. Okay. So we have a cuvette, and the standard is a 1 centimeter or 10 millimeter cuvette. And we put our sample in there, and the light passes through, and that path length, the amount of that sample it's passing through, is typically 1 centimeter or 10 millimeters. But you can have a big cell. This is a 5 centimeter cell. It's also very dirty. There's fuzz in there or something. Okay, and look, you can even and this cell has a hat that goes on top of it. Hey, the hat doesn't fit. Must have got a big head. Anyway, it says right on the end of it. Oh, it says it's glass. Is what it says. I think my eyesight's getting pretty bad. But so you can have different path lengths, but you know, pretty much everybody uses a 1 centimeter path length, and then of course concentration. So absorbance is related to the intensities, but we rarely measure the intensities directly. We don't measure. I don't measure the intensity of the source, then measure the intensity that's transmitted. The instrument does that for me, does the ratio measurement, so I don't worry about that. What I do worry about is absorbance and these parameters, but the path length is fixed at 1 centimeter, typically, so I don't worry too much about that. It becomes 1. And then my molar absorptivity, I'm stuck with the molar absorptivity of the stuff because that's what the boss told me to measure, right? He gave me the sample and he said, measure this. So I'm stuck with its molar absorptivity. So I can relate absorbance to concentration with Beer's law. Some people use transmittance, or sometimes in some situations we like to use transmittance. And that's a plastic cuvette. That's why I threw it. So percent T is defined differently than absorbance. It's transmitted intensity divided by source intensity, no logarithm. Okay, so we often use transmittance, or sometimes we use percent transmittance, which you just multiply by 100. Okay, Beer's law, real important. Oh, look at that! I got that. Beer's law is real important, and particularly to the analytical person who wants to make some measurements. But you know, everybody's doing UV visible absorption. Probably wrong. They're probably doing it incorrectly. But everybody's going to use a UV visible instrument probably at some point in their life. All right, we're going to talk about the cuvette. I got my gigantic cuvette that I drew for you. Okay, and my gigantic cuvette is just a rendition of this little thing here. And we're going to talk about now. We spent some time dealing with optical parameters, right? We talked about scattering. We talked about absorption and emission. We talked about, what else did we talk about? Refractive index. We talked about reflection, okay? Four of those things that we talked about in the last two classes are going to be important when it comes to this cuvette. When it comes to light passing through the cuvette, you putting this into a spectrophotometer and shining light through your sample, at least four of those parameters that I discussed with you already are going to be important in this cuvette. Okay, so Beer's law only deals with absorption. Okay, so effects other than absorption. So this equation here, ugly, only deals with absorption, and anything else is a problem. So effects other than absorption that reduce the source intensity, so there's scattering, there's reflection, okay, may also be measured as absorbance and may be accounted for when measuring I and I zero. So how do you account for them? Okay, how do you account for all these other effects? Well, you do a blank measurement, right? You do a you put your solvent. So let's say I'm going to measure the aspirin, acetyl salicylic acid, in water. So I dissolve, I take an aspirin tablet and I grind it up, or I take the big giant bottle of aspirin. Do we still have the big giant bottle? We had like a kilogram bottle of aspirin. If you got a headache, we got the stuff. Okay. Anyway, and you dissolve some in water and you put it here. Now, if I'm concerned that there's some reflection losses and scattering losses and so forth, then I'm going to take distilled water and measure that first, get a blank reading, and then put my sample of acetyl salicylic acid dissolved in water and make an absorbance measurement on that. So, let's talk about it. Light losses occur due to reflection. Okay, we talked about reflection. Remember the 4% deal? You know, just because of the refractive index, right? The refractive index of air is equal to 1.00, however many zeros you want to stick after that. But the refractive index of the cuvette, now this cuvette's plastic, but this cuvette's glass, and then you can have a quartz cuvette, but they all have some refractive index. And so we have to plug that into the equation. We find out that, sure enough, when the light passes from the air into the glass, there's going to be some reflection losses. And there they are. So a little bit of the light, 4%, is reflecting off. But the light then passes through the wall of the cuvette. Now I know, it's a gigantic cuvette, so the wall is thick. But, you know, in case you have bad eyesight, you can, you know. There's a thickness, there's a finite thickness to the wall of that cuvette, right? The internal dimension of this cuvette, right? This distance from here to here is B. right? My path length, which is typically 1 centimeter, equals 10 millimeters. Right? But there's a thickness to the wall, and the wall of the cuvette is also going to have a amount of light that passes through it, and some of it that scatters off. Or not scatters, reflects. Okay, reflection, 4%. So we got 4% here, and another 4% here. Okay, the sample, or the light beam, passes through the sample. All right, so we show. Now, what am I doing? I'm trying to indicate something to you that the light beam is getting smaller. It doesn't really get smaller this way, but I'm just showing you that the intensity of the beam diminishes because of absorption. So in here, there's some processes going on. Absorption may not be the only process. I mentioned scattering. So we have reflection at the boundaries, all right, that's shown in my little diagram, and then scattering by molecules or particles. Right? I said to you that even water scatters light. If you take a sample, a cuvette, and fill it with water and put it in a distilled water, nothing in it, no particles, no anything. We talked about Rayleigh scattering. Okay, scattering that occurs because the wavelength of light is on the order of, what did we say, less than 5 to 10% of the size of the molecule. Actually, what is it? No, it's the wavelength, the molecules. We have to go back to your notes and look this up. Particles that are less than 5 to 10% of the wavelength of light. I think I said it right the first time. I'm trying to confuse myself. Okay, so a water molecule, you know, H2O, with its particular bond length and so forth, happens to be the right size to scatter with some efficiency certain wavelengths of light. UV, visible region of the spectrum. As it turns out, because of that fourth power dependence in the Rayleigh scattering equation, the scattering gets more intense as you get to into the UV region, shorter wavelengths. But there's some scattering. So I depicted that here with some arrows going off in different directions. By the way, if you have particles in there, you know, fuzz, gunk, whatever it is, okay, you didn't clean your sample up real well, you're going to get more scattering. You got some. You ever make a solution of a protein? Make a protein solution, or a polymer solution. Sometimes there's a haze. You look at it; it's not a crystal clear. It's got a haze to it. What is that? It's scattering. It's light scattering. It's a Tyndall effect. It's you can actually see the light scattering off of these off of the molecules. And in the case of a large molecule like a polymer or a protein, that effect is very great, very large, and so the solution looks kind of hazy. It looks like it's cloudy, but you filtered it, or there's nothing precipitating out. It's just light scattering occurring. Okay, then we have, let's see, what else? Light then passes out of the cuvette, but of course there's more scattering here at this surface, and then as we go out to our detector, there's scattering here. So we went through all that the other day. We have four surfaces, here, here, and here, where there's scattering occurring, reflection occurring. Did I say scattering? I meant reflection. Reflection losses occurring due to that refractive index difference going from air to the cuvette material, glass, plastic, quartz, going from that material into the sample, which is in some solvent, water maybe, cyclohexane, you know, methylene chloride, whatever solvent you happen to like to use or is works for your sample, there's a refractive index difference between the cuvette and that material, and then going back into the quartz, glass, or plastic of the cuvette, and then out into the air, we get scattering. I keep saying scattering. Reflection at each of those surfaces. So we got reflection losses, then we may have scattering by molecules or particles in our sample. And then, of course, there's the absorption process. That's what we're actually interested in. Okay, so we've got the absorption process. All of those things occurring in this particular scenario that we're painting for our UV visible absorption measurement, right? And this Beer's Law effect. Well, how do I differentiate between light attenuation, right? My source has an I0, an intensity, And then the sample diminishes that intensity, gives me some lower intensity that's transmitted through. But how do I differentiate between absorption and scattering? Absorption and reflection. Absorption and anything else that might be going on in the sample. Okay? Well, one way you do it is with the blank. Right? So you fill the thing with water, the same solvent, same conditions. Maybe you even are more sophisticated than that, and you have a company called me yesterday that happens to make contact lenses. Probably number one, number two contact lens manufacturer in the world. And they said, we want you to measure certain components, proprietary components, in their lens cleaning solution. Okay? Well, I got to know what's in it. Okay, what's in your lens cleaning solution? Well, it's got this, and it's got that, and it's got all these things in it. It actually only has about 5 components in it. Well, they were doing some UV visible measurements and having a hard time with these particular components that are disinfectants that prevent gunk from growing in the lens cleaning solution. But in order to do a blank, you've got to have their lens cleaning solution without those. You know, if you want the lens cleaning solution and all the other components, you want to do a good blank. You want to have the other components in there. So what's in there? Well, it's saline. There's some salt in there. There's a little bit of saline solution in there, right, to get the right similar osmotic pressure to your eye. So when you take the lens out of the lens cleaning solution, people use their finger all the time. I said, where's that finger been? Is it clean? Okay. Anyway, they stick the lens on the end of their finger, right, and then they jam it into their eye. Okay. And but that solution has to have a similar osmotic pressure similar concentration of salt in it as the fluids in your eye, so you don't have an osmotic pressure difference. So there's salt in the solution. There are certain polymers in there. Okay. So I want to do a blank. I've got to make up a blank that has all the stuff in it, but we're measuring the absorbance of their two particular components that they want to measure. And so to do a good blank, I've got everything in there except the species of interest that absorbs. Okay, that way I'll get the same scattering. This time I mean scattering. Okay, from the polymers that are in there, the water soluble polymers that are going to scatter a little bit of light. I'm using water. I'm using the same cuvette or an optically matched cuvette, and so I get the same reflection losses. And so I'm able to account for these other things. Okay, it says here. Other effects other than absorption can be accounted for by using a blank, right? By using a blank, as I described. Okay, absorbance and transmittance are unitless, right? Because it's a ratio, kind of a measurement. If concentration is in moles per liter, that's chemistry talk, right? Moles per liter. When we're doing absorbance measurements, we use moles per liter. If B is in centimeters, okay, the path length is in centimeters, then the molar absorptivity is in liters per mole centimeter. All right? To minimize light effects, blah, 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 blah. I zero with a reference blank, pure solvent, or, as I mentioned to you, it could have other components in there of the general system to do a better blank measurement. But I might need to measure distilled water, then the components that are non-absorbing in the lens cleaning solution, because that's what I'm doing today. So now I've got a water blank, a solution blank, a matrix blank, and then I've got my solution that actually has the components that I'm interested in measuring the absorbance of. So I have a couple of blanks, right? Okay, so it's measured under the same conditions. Cuvettes should be optically matched. So you can buy a cuvette. Now, plastic ones, you know, you buy them in a case, right? A whole bunch, you know, you buy a couple of dozen of them, and they're somewhat matched, okay? And they only work usually in the visible region. UV light, the plastic will absorb UV light, so these plastic cuvettes are good for demonstrations because they don't break. But may not be good for what you're doing. But you want to buy a good set of quartz cuvettes, matched quartz cuvettes. You're going to pay a couple hundred dollars for them. They're matched optically. They have the same properties in terms of reflection losses and scattering from the cuvette itself. Okay, and over the entire spectrum, UV invisible, they give you the same properties. So now I can set up my two cuvettes and I can put water in one and my sample in the other one, and maybe I even have a double beam instrument where I put both cuvettes in at once and it ratios the intensity of light that passes through the blank versus the sample. Matched cuvettes can be important. If you're on a budget, okay, you don't have enough money, then you use one cuvette. And you're real careful. You don't drop it. Okay, you don't break it. We have a drawer full of broken cuvettes right next to the drawer full of broken pH meters. Okay, from students who have dropped cuvettes. So you don't put water in it. Okay, you make a measurement. You dump the water out. You rinse it with your sample. Make a measurement. Now, you do have to concern yourself with the cleanliness of the windows, right? So you got to clean it off, right? You can use a Kim wipe if it's quartz or something like that. You can use lens paper. Some people are, you don't want to scratch it. But, you know, quartz is a very hard material. You know, it's not going to be scratched very easily. You don't want little fingerprints on there. You don't want droplets of solution on there. You don't want bubbles in your solution, right? You don't want any kind of lint or, you know, garbage on the outside of this thing. It's got to be clean, and because anything that's there will cause a light scattering reflection kind of a loss. Okay, clean, free of scratches, lint, fingerprints, etc. Okay. Beer's law applies to all absorption processes. Let me just mention, I probably have it somewhere here, but if you were to do X-ray absorption, Beer's law works for X-ray absorption. Beer's law works for infrared absorption. You can do infrared measurements. People don't do it very often because the infrared region, remember the Boltzmann's distribution, it's lousy. The molar absorptivities are very small. So the proportionality constant between A, absorbance, and C, concentration, is small. It's not a very sensitive relationship. So people don't do much quantitative measurements by IR, but you can. And you can buy cells that have, you know, a liquid cell, for example. We have one downstairs with salt windows. And it tells you, written right on it, is the thickness of the space between the windows. So if you were to fill it with a solvent, you know exactly what the the path length is. And it's not 1 centimeter. It's some very thin path length. But so you can do it with infrared, you can do it with any of these techniques, but it's very extremely important in the UV visible because we can easily adjust or alter our path length. In the case of X-rays, a lot of times it's a solid sample, you don't have much control over it. Or in the gamma ray system, whatever your sample is, that's what your path length is. You're not going to be... you may want to control it a little bit and make all your samples the same, so your standards and your samples are similar. But again, Beer's law applies in all these cases. All right, assumptions. I'm going to give you 4 assumptions made in deriving Beer's law. Only interactions between the radiation, known as light, and the absorber, or sample, is absorption. Well, this is not rocket science here. This is pretty simple stuff. What it's saying is, though, that Beer's law doesn't have anything to do with the reflection that occurs or the scattering that occurs. You have to compensate for that. So that's why we go through all the trouble of doing the blanks and doing a not just a distilled water blank, but maybe a blank that has the other components of your real-world sample in it. Okay, if you were measuring, what is everybody? Everybody in the news today is concerned about lead in lipstick. Okay, I just stopped wearing lipstick. Okay, that was my solution to the problem. Okay? But if you, whatever you're measuring, real world samples, you have to concern yourself with the matrix. Okay, and the matrix may cause scattering or reflection losses to occur. That's not accounted for in the derivation of Beer's law. If the light is re-emitted, okay, we're measuring absorption. Right now we're going to do all absorption for most of the semester. At the end of the semester, I'll spend a couple of lectures on fluorescence, which is an emission technique, re-emission of the absorbed light. Well, if I have re-emission in my sample and it is measured at my detector, that may be an error. Okay, that light that was absorbed is being re-emitted. If that's a significant contribution to the overall amount of light that's absorbed, that may cause a problem with Beer's law. Beer's law doesn't account for that. Okay. Also, stray radiation. So we've got reflection, scattering, okay, fluorescence, and stray radiation. We talked about stray light a little bit. Okay. In my spectrophotometer, I'll talk to you more about this when we deal with this, building the spectrophotometer. But do you notice it's all painted black inside of there? Okay. You never looked inside, huh? Okay. You're not supposed to look inside. It voids the warranty or whatever. But we love to take things apart. And inside the spectrophotometer, they paint everything black to absorb stray light. So if light scatters off at one angle or another, it absorbs, hits a black surface and is absorbed and not reflected around inside and causing an error in the measurement that you make. So none of these things, scattering, reflection, fluorescence, or stray light, are accounted for in Beer's law where it's derived. So we have to concern ourselves with that. Again, when I said all kinds of people make measurements using UV visible absorption all the time, they may make their measurements incorrectly, okay, because they don't account for some of these phenomena. They don't worry about scattering or reflection. Okay, here's another assumption. Beer's law says that we're using monochromatic radiation. Okay, mono meaning one, chromatic meaning color. Okay, so one color. We're only using one color of light. Right, so that means if I have a salicylic acid, what color is 300 nanometers? It doesn't have a color. It's ultraviolet. All right, but I'm only using 300 nanometer radiation. That's what this is saying. If I was going to measure the absorbance of aspirin, which I think absorbs around 300 nanometers. Did you do that last semester? But you don't remember what it was. Right? Okay. Then you're only going to use 300 nanometers. Now, there's no such thing as just 300 nanometers. We live in an analog world, not a digital world. Okay. And so when I set my spectrophotometer to 300 nanometers, I don't just get 300 nanometers. Okay, I get a range or a band of radiation. Okay, a band of radiation. That band of radiation depicted here is as a yellow band. Yellow is kind of a lousy color for slides, just for future reference. But I got this off the internet. Okay, so here's a plot of absorbance on the y-axis versus wavelength. So this is a spectrum. This is my spectrum, we'll say, of aspirin. And I'm looking at it with a band of radiation, but I only selected 300 nanometers. So right here is 300 nanometers. But my instrument doesn't provide me with one wavelength of light. It provides me with a band of radiation. So it may be that over here, it's actually 301. And over here, it's 299. And so I have what is referred to by spectroscopists as a 2 nanometer band pass. You said, no, that's 3 nanometers. No, it's only 2 nanometers. Count them. It's only 2 nanometers. Okay? All right? 299, 300 to 301. It's only 2 nanometers. Okay? So we have a 2 nanometer band pass. It's a band of radiation that... that we're actually using to make the measurement. Now, 2 nanometer bandpass is a pretty reasonable bandpass. It's not a big band of radiation. It's a narrow band. It's not too bad. It approximates monochromatic radiation, but it's not monochromatic radiation. The problem comes about as the band of radiation overlaps this spectrum. So here, I told you, this is my spectrum, right? And I'm making my measurement at the maximum absorbance, the wavelength of maximum absorbance, and this is a fictitious example because aspirin may not absorb at 300, but it's got a benzene ring in it, and benzene rings absorb in that neighborhood, so I'm thinking it's about 300 nanometers. Salicylic acid, which is a very related compound, does absorb at 300 nanometers. So anyway, here's the problem. Well, here's the non-problem, right? In example number one, the slope of the line right there, what's the slope of that line? Who's good with math? The slope of the line that I drew. The slope of that line is zero, okay? I'm helping you, okay? The slope of that line is zero, right? It has no slope. It's zero, okay? There's no rise. It's running, but there's no rise. So it has a slope of zero. Well, if I'm a little bit off, okay, in my measurement, in other words, I'm not right at the maximum. If I'm a little bit over here or a little bit over here, it's not going to matter that much because the slope is zero and there's no change. Okay. However, if I were to be over here, if I'm a lot off and I'm on the side of my absorption band, then the absorption changes dramatically over this region that I've highlighted in red. It has a very substantial slope. Okay. This is the crux of the problem with a band of radiation. Okay, if the actual absorbance is 300 nanometers, but I have other wavelengths of light in there that don't absorb the same, right? If they don't absorb the same amount as 300 nanometers, then what I'm getting is an average or a summation of the absorbance of the light over this range of wavelengths that are not all the optimum wavelength. 300 nanometers is the optimum, the one where the molar absorptivity of the sample is the maximum. But I've got these other wavelengths of light in there as well, and they don't have the same molar absorptivity. This kind of messes things up for Beer's law. Right? This kind of messes things up. What if I have a 10 nanometer bandpass? It's not uncommon for a cheap, otherwise known as inexpensive instrument, to have a wide bandpass. And therefore, I've got a range of wavelengths that are absorbing differently than the 300 nanometer band that I really want, the 300 nanometer wavelength, monochromatic wavelength that I really want. Here's what this tells me, okay? This comes about because the molar absorptivity, epsilon, varies, okay, with wavelength. And in case one, I would get a linear calibration plot. This would be absorbance versus concentration would be linear. But in case two, okay, where I'm on the side of the curve, or I'm off, and again, there's about three problems. Two or three problems here. The width of the band of the radiation, where I am in relation to that band of radiation, and then what that results in terms of my calibration plot. So if I'm not at this place near the top of the curve where the slope is zero and there's not much change, but I'm off to the side somewhere, then I'm going to get a curved calibration curve. I'm going to get a plot that looks like this. Okay, that's a problem. That could be a problem. Somebody's going to say, wait, Beer's law doesn't work. Well, it doesn't work if you use it incorrectly. Okay, so monochromatic radiation is only approximated because we have a bandwidth. Now I've introduced a term, bandwidth, sometimes also known as band pass. Okay, we'll revisit this. Band pass or spectral slit width is another term that's used. Okay, but it just means that band of radiation. And Beer's law says monochromatic. Okay, the closer I approximate, the better. The closer I approximate monochromatic radiation, the better. If I deviate from that significantly, I got a problem. All right. Beer's law says that the path length is the same over the volume that's being measured. In a square cuvette, that is the case, right? The path length is the same. It's 1 centimeter on this edge. It's 1 centimeter on this edge. It's 1 centimeter in the middle. However, if I were to use a round cuvette, okay, as is common for the spectronic 20 instruments that they use in freshman chemistry. Okay, they use a test tube. They set up little test tubes. Why? Because they're cheap. The plastic ones are not that expensive, but the glass or quartz cuvettes are significant money. We're not going to let 350 freshmen use expensive cuvettes. We let them use test tubes. So they stick a round cuvette into the light beam. But the problem is that the path length is different. It's different. It's longer in the middle and shorter on the edges. Doesn't actually fit Beer's law. So a round cell is not a good cell. Okay? Sometimes it's okay. And again, for the freshman to get the principle of absorption and so forth, it works. But to make careful measurements, a round cell is not a good way to do things as far as Beer's law is concerned. All right? So that's a problem. You couple that with the fact that the light beam varies. It's a band, okay? And we'll see later that the band of radiation that comes out of your instrument and goes through your sample probably has a range of wavelengths. Now, I exaggerated it. I got the full spectrum in there, right? I got red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. I got seven arrows, okay? I got the full spectrum. You're not going to use the full spectrum, probably. But you might. There are situations where you will use the full spectrum if you're using a photodiode array type instrument. You might use the full spectrum of light passing through the sample. And if the spectrum of light varies across the band, where, in other words, on one side it's red, and on the other side it's orange or yellow, okay? So there's a range of wavelengths across there. Some of those wavelengths are passing through the full thickness of the cell, and some of them are passing through the edge of the cell where there's only a smaller path length. This is a problem for Beer's law. Okay, so I have actually two things combined here. The path length is different across the volume, and then different components of the path length are absorbed differently. So that's what this says. Right? The same consequence occurs that we saw on the last slide. If you drew a plot of absorbance versus concentration, it would be curved. So there's a lot of things that can cause curved plots for Beer's law, and that's a problem. Here's one. The nature of the absorber, according to Beer's law, cannot change or should not change. All right. So I've got A plus A, that would be 2A, reacts, A dimerizes and forms, I would write it this way. I would write it 2A forms A2. Anyway, so you have a substance, A, that you're trying to measure the absorbance of. As you increase its concentration, it decides to dimerize. Okay, it forms a dimer. The dimer may not have the same molar absorptivity as the monomer. Okay, it may not absorb twice as much because there's two of them. Okay, it may only absorb 1.5 times as much as one. So there's a chemical change going on. Now this dimerization is one example. We saw before when I talked about electrochemistry, I talked about complexation reactions, acid-base reactions. Acid-base reactions are real common. Right. If I were to take, going on the theme of the substituted aromatics that I've been on today, if I were to take salicylic acid, benzene ring with a carboxylic acid group and a phenolic group, ortho to each other. Okay, so it's a benzene ring, two groups hanging off of it. Both of those groups are acidic. The carboxylic acid group can lose a proton, but so can the phenolic group, actually. So it matters what the acid-base condition of that molecule is regarding its molar absorptivity. The fully protonated species versus the mono-deprotonated species, the carboxylic acid group comes off, proton comes off first, or the fully deprotonated. There's three forms of that molecule. Okay. And I'm forgetting exactly, the acid does not absorb as much as the, I believe that's the way it is, as the deprotonated forms. The two deprotonated forms absorb about the same amount, but the fully protonated acid absorbs less at 300 nanometers. That's my recollection anyway. So there's a chemistry change going on with that molecule that affects its molar absorptivity. That's what this is talking about. Beer's law doesn't account for that. It doesn't have any way of knowing that there's a difference in absorbance. You have to figure that out for yourself. So if something happens to the molecule under the conditions that you're measuring it, you know, I got two solutions and they're the same concentration, but one's at a different pH than the other one, and they have different molar absorptivities because I have a deprotonated, protonated molecule in the two different solutions, then I may get a different response in my UV visible absorption measurement, and Beer's law doesn't take that into account. So this gives you the example of a dimer. But it could be anything. It could be acid base, could be complexation, could be any number of reaction scenarios that give rise to changes in Beer's law. Okay. All of the above mentioned deviations from Beer's law, sometimes called instrumental deviations, or in the case of narrow bands, wide bands, round cells, square cells, those are more instrumental. The dimerization thing is more like a chemical, what would be referred to as a chemical deviation. They only deviations in the sense that your conditions don't match the conditions under which Beer's law was derived. Okay, it has some assumptions, and if you don't follow the assumptions, all bets are off. You don't know what you're going to get. Beer's law always applies if used properly. Okay, all right. Let me shift gears and talk about types of spectroscopy. I've already talked about it a little bit, so this will be a quickie review. If we're going to do absorption, we could do atomic absorption. We're not going to cover that in this class, all right? But atomic absorption is basically the same thing. It uses Beer's law. The path length is the burner. You know, there's a burner in flame atomic absorption, right? You've got a slot burner. The distance of the flame across the flame is your path length. You're putting atoms into the path. You're selecting wavelengths at which those atoms absorb. And you can do absorption spectroscopy, but it's atomic absorption. It's quite a bit different than the kind of absorption spectroscopy we're going to do. We're doing molecular absorption because we're using cuvettes and we're not using any flames. If you're into flames, okay, we it's a different course. So we can do atomic absorption. We're not going to talk about that here. We are going to talk about molecular absorption. Okay, we're going to be talking about this right here, and we're going to be talking about UV-Vis, okay, which is electronic absorption. We talked about that, or mentioned that. We'll talk about infrared absorption a little bit. I'll mention it. Okay, I won't get into the modes of vibrations. You got to take structural analysis for that. Microwave absorption, dealing with rotations around bonds. I'll mention it. I've mentioned it. I probably won't mention it again. NMR in the radio wave region, megahertz region, nuclear spin, ESR, EPR, gigahertz region, electron spin. Okay. Then we can deal with emission techniques like atomic emission, okay, or atomic fluorescence. Both of them are emission techniques, whether we're talking about straight emission or fluorescence-type emission. And there's a minor distinction between those two, but we're not covering that here in this class. We are going to deal with molecular emission, and I won't until the end of the semester, last few classes, I'll talk about fluorescence, which is very important analytically. I'll talk about phosphorescence a little bit, not that important analytically. I'll talk about chemiluminescence, also not real important, but has some importance, okay? So, you know, these two are sort of marginalized. Fluorescence is the biggie, all right? And these are all luminescence techniques, and we're interested in the UV visible region of the spectrum. Scattering, light interacting with matter, okay, I guess we can include that. I've already mentioned Raman spectroscopy, turbidimetry and nephelometry. Again, regions of the spectrum. I'm not going to spend any time on these. I've already mentioned index of refraction, refractometry, optical rotatory dispersion, etc. This is about the extent to which we're going to cover them. But you need to know. Okay, you need to realize that these things are techniques that are used in this region of the spectrum and so forth. Okay, we're going to focus our attention on ultraviolet, visible, and a little bit about infrared instrumentation. Focus our measurements in the UV visible region. There's good instrumentation available, good sources, good detectors, good monochromators, wavelength dispersion devices. Very widely used techniques. The methods have been around for a long time. We'll consider IR a little bit because there's some similarities. Okay, we need to talk about how you make absorption measurements. Five basic components are necessary to make an absorption measurement. You need a source of radiation. It could be the sun. We don't use the sun that much anymore. Okay, but you need a source of radiation. You need a device for dispersing that radiation into its component wavelengths, right? I don't want to use the whole, all the wavelengths. I want to select the band of radiation that I'm going to use. So I need a device to do that. We'll talk about three ways in which you can do that in this course. We need a way to put the sample into the path length of the light. Well, that's easy. We got a cuvette, so we're not going to spend much time with that. We've already talked about cuvettes. Skinny cuvettes, fat cuvettes, we got them all, okay? Different shape flow through cuvettes, all right? Really narrow, you can get the cuvettes that have really short path lengths, right? If you have a high molar absorptivity substance or something. But we won't talk a lot about those. Detectors we'll spend some time on, okay? That kind of convert the light into an electrical signal that we can measure. And then some kind of readout device. Most of the time it's going to be a computer these days, all right, but there's these other antiques known as recorders and integrators and meters, but nobody uses that stuff anymore. Okay. All right, absorption measurements, block diagram. There's the light source. There's the device for selecting the wavelength. Notice that when coming out of light source is a range of wavelengths, a whole bunch of wavelengths. Okay. When it goes through the wavelength selector, I then narrow it down to the band of radiation that I want. And that's going to be my I0 intensity that goes into my sample. All right? Then I got my sample holder. Coming out of my sample holder, on the other side of the sample, is the I, okay, the transmitted source intensity. It's been transmitted through the sample. So I got I0 and I. That goes into my detector. Okay, and then I get signal processing and readout. Here the wavelength of interest is selected first. Okay, so we select the wavelength, then we send it through the sample. Now, watch this. Abracadabra, presto, change-o. Okay, the location of these can be reversed. Look at that, I reversed them. Okay, so now the light comes out of my source, and it goes, the whole range of wavelengths goes through my sample. Coming out of the sample are the intensities, but it's all wavelengths of light that are passing through here. Then it goes into my wavelength selector, which picks the band that I want to detect. Okay? And here they all go through. Okay, now, why would you do that? You would do that in a case where you had an array detector, a detector that measures a whole band of radiation. And you may not even have a wavelength selector here. You may have a dispersion device that disperses the wavelengths onto the face of a diode array or a charge coupled device. Everybody's got a charge coupled device, right? There's one in here, right? You can't buy a telephone anymore without a camera in it. I tried. No, sorry, you got to take the camera. So if a light, if I pass the whole band of radiation through my sample, then I disperse it. I can measure across the face of my CCD, right, my charge coupled device or my array detector or whatever type of detector you're using, I can have the entire spectrum across the face of that device, and I can be measuring the different wavelengths at different pixels on my CCD, for example. And that's a way a lot of measurements are made today. Okay. Emission measurements require some similar devices, but not, there's a little bit of difference. Okay, we do have a means of exciting the emission, but not necessarily a light source. Now, it can be a light source. In fluorescence and phosphorescence, it's a light source. In chemiluminescence, it's not a light source. It's chemical excitation. We're going to perform a chemical reaction that excites the the emission of radiation. So we have to have a means of exciting that emission, a way of populating the upper states, as it says here. Then they emit spontaneously, and then we disperse, which we did in the previous slide. We got to put the sample in the path length. We got to have a detector, readout device. Okay, so same kinds of things. Block diagram of a fluorescence or phosphorescence instrument. We have a light source, a wavelength selection device. Okay, out of the light source comes a range of wavelengths. They go into the wavelength selection device. That selected band of radiation is my I0, just like before. But now I'm measuring at a right angle. Okay, I'm measuring the light that's emitted at a right angle. So I comes out this way. There's also some light passing through this way, but I don't care about that light. I want to look at the fluorescence that's coming out, or the phosphorescence that's coming out at right angles, and it won't be interfered with by this light that's coming through the sample this way. So I measure at right angles. I say I have a wavelength selection device. My band that I select is over here. Goes to my detector, signal processing, readout, so forth. Okay. Requirements of components for different instruments changes with the type of spectroscopy. Right? So the detectors, we're going to talk about detectors in the UV visible region. Well, I'll mention for comparison the kinds of detectors that are used in the IR region. They're different. IR detectors are different. We're measuring infrared radiation, the sort of heat-based detectors, okay, detectors that measure heat in the infrared region, compared with photons that are more energetic in the UV visible region. And likewise, in the X-ray region or whatever region you're in, the components are going to differ a little bit. We're going to consider the components separately, and we'll talk about theory and practice. Let me talk about sources. We're moving right along here. Let me talk about sources in the UV visible region. Several important characteristics for these sources. We could talk about their spectral distribution. That's a fancy way of saying their intensity versus wavelength. Right? They're going to have some intensity. Any source of light, okay, this source of light coming out of the ceiling here, has some distribution of wavelengths. That distribution happens to be defined by that white stuff, that powdery white stuff that's on the inside of those tubes. You know what that is? Calcium fluoride, phosphor. Okay? That is a phosphorescent substance. Why do they call them fluorescent lights? Some idiot named them. They're really, they call them fluorescent lights, right? They should call them phosphorescent lights. But that substance, that white powdery substance, which absorbs energy from a ultraviolet light source, a mercury discharge lamp, puts out a spectrum of light, but it's some range of wavelengths. It doesn't put out everything. These are a lot whiter than a little light bulb, an incandescent light bulb. You ever notice how an incandescent light bulb, if you've been in fluorescent lights all day, in my office I have a desk lamp that has a little light bulb in it. It's kind of yellow. Why? It's the other end of the spectrum. This is the near the UV end, because the mercury lamp puts out UV and the phosphor shifts that into the visible, the short end of the visible. So I get very white, blue almost, end of the spectrum light. I go to my desk lamp, and it's incandescence, a la Thomas Edison, and I end up with a hot source that puts out more in the longer wavelengths. This is a different color. Do you ever notice today, you drive down the highway, the headlights coming at you from the other cars are all different colors. Everybody's into halogens. Well, halogens are so passe now. People are into xenon headlights. Xenon, like you really need xenon, like you really need $200 headlights. You know, if you want $200 headlights, great. Okay, you're going to get them ripped off. You go down to Boston, somebody's going to steal your headlights. Okay, but those really bright white lights, or almost blue lights that are coming at you, then you see some that are kind of yellow. Okay, the yellow ones are the old-fashioned incandescent lamps, headlights. Then they went to tungsten. That shifts it a little bit. Tungsten halogen. They're all tungsten filaments. Tungsten lights are kind of yellowish. Tungsten halogen are a little more whiter. And then they got into xenon and all sorts of other things that are helium lamps. But there's a distribution. I get off on tangents here. Spectral distribution. Some sources are continuum. Some are line. Okay, line sources. Mercury is a line source. We'll talk about line sources and versus continuum sources that put out the full wavelength. We'll talk about the intensity of the source. Some things are more intense than others, have different applications. Some sources are very stable, long life. Okay, some are not stable. They don't have a long life. Oh, actually, I have lifetimes down here. Stable, I guess, what I'm trying to put across here is short-term fluctuations. They're noisy. Some sources are noisy intrinsically. Some are stable intrinsically, and they don't drift or change with time. Some are expensive. Some are expensive and have short lifetimes. That's a bad mix. And then geometry. A lot of sources put out light in all directions, but some don't. Lasers put out a monodirectional light beam, right? Well, that could be good for spectroscopy, right? Not good for lighting the room up, but I wouldn't recommend you use a laser to light your living room, but you could, I suppose. Oh, I meant to do this. Okay. Let's talk about continuum sources first. This is Roman numeral 1, Arabic numeral 1. I sometimes lose track of my outlining here as I go along. Continuum sources, incandescent sources. Okay, so that's Thomas Edison, right? Tom Edison. You know what he did? He had a sweatshop. He had a big building, and he had hundreds of people trying out different filaments, right? A couple of wires. They connect the filament between the two wires. They turn on the electricity, and the thing would burn out. Okay, but it's the incandescent process. Found out. Okay, you've got to put that in a inert atmosphere. What's inside of light bulbs? Argon. Okay, the biggest use of argon on the planet is for light bulbs. Okay, inside of light bulbs, right? So that the tungsten filament does not burn out. The incandescent process, from a physics point of view, approaches what's referred to as a theoretical black body. Okay, puts out black body radiation. A black body is a theoretical construct. It's a perfect absorber, perfect emitter. The physicists like to talk about this stuff when they talk about astrophysics and black holes and all sorts of black body radiation coming from outer space. But let's keep it on Earth here. An incandescent source approaches, not very well, a black body, perfect absorber, perfect emitter type of system. Reason we care about that is because of this right here. The fact that its total power is proportional to, the squiggly line here just means it's related to or proportional to, the temperature to the fourth power. Hotter you get it, okay? The hotter you get it, the more light you get out. So if I take my incandescent light source, again, something Thomas Edison figured out, if I put a little bit of light, a little bit of electricity to it, I get an orange glow. I put more electricity to it, I get a yellow glow. I turn up the juice a little bit more, I get a white glow. I turn it up a little bit more, and it burns out, okay? But this is black body behavior. The greater the power or the greater power output comes as we increase the temperature of that incandescent filament or that source. Okay? It follows Planck's radiation law, which is basically this up here. Here's a diagram that tells you that there's profiles on here. So if I take that incandescent light bulb, okay, it's hot. Right? If I run it at 3,000 degrees, I get this kind of a spectral distribution shown down here. Okay, that distribution doesn't do me a lot of good. Why? Because I can't see 1,000 nanometers. I can feel it. It's warm. Okay, on a day like today, you might want to huddle around your incandescent light bulb. If I jack the temperature up a little bit and I run that incandescent filament at 4,000 degrees K, I get greater intensity, and I shift the maximum to shorter wavelengths. So now I'm getting 4,000 degrees. I got a little bit better. The total power output is giving me more visible light. That's what I want. I want to see it, right? More visible light, and it's shifted to shorter wavelengths. I go to even hotter temperatures, 5,000 degrees. I'm shifted more. Now I still got a lot of intensity over here that I can't see. It's wasted. Right downstairs in my office, the light bulb is on. It's wasted. Well, actually, it'll warm my office up. So when I get down there, it'll be warm. Okay, but it's not gonna. I can't see that light. I can't see this radiation over here. In spectroscopic applications, the near infrared is a pretty useless region of the spectrum. Some uses, but not a lot. So an incandescent light source will give me visible light, right, across the spectrum, blue, green, yellow, orange, red, okay? So I can get some good light there. The near infrared region, that's not going to help me a lot unless I want to do near IR spectroscopy. That incandescent source, guess what? It's not going to give me much in the UV region. This would be the UV region over here. It's not giving me much there. All right? That's a typical profile for, again, a tungsten filament, little tungsten wire housed in an inner atmosphere. If I don't house it in an inner atmosphere, what happens? It oxidizes. It burns up. And I need high temperature. Okay. In the infrared region, there are several incandescent sources, things that we can apply energy to, electrical energy, heat them up, and they give off infrared radiation. There's the Nernst blower. It's made up of zirconium oxide, yttrium oxide, and thorium oxide, operated at 1900 degrees C, and it gives you better, shorter wavelength or near IR radiation. There's a Glowbar. Silicon carbide. These are pretty popular in infrared instruments. Okay, normally operated 1200 to 1400 degrees C. Better at longer infrared radiation wavelengths. Okay, but is not a good black body type source. Doesn't meet the theoretical criteria. But who cares? If it works, we use it. All right. An incandescent wire like the one I just told you, tungsten, or this one's nichrome, any kind of alloy will work to some extent. They won't work as good as tungsten. Tungsten turns out to be the best. All of those sources are operated at relatively low temperature. If we turn them up too high, they burn out. They're good for IR. They give some visible. If you turn them on, you can actually see a little bit of a glow. A little bit of a reddish glow to those Nernst glower, glow bar, or an incandescent wire. Most of them for IR are operated in air, but they will burn up after a while. Okay, Nernst glower, low power consumption, operates in air, has a pretty long lifetime. The glow bar is more stable, requires more power, must be cooled, and has a longer life. Maybe air cooled. Okay, could be air-cooled. The resistance of the system changes with time, and so the characteristics of the source actually change with time. So it's not going to give you necessarily the same thing this month as it did last month. A little bit of a problem. In the visible region, we're going to use a simple light bulb. Okay, in your tungsten filament light bulb. So if you rip open a UV instrument, UV visible instrument, inside there is going to be a light bulb, okay, for the visible part of the spectrum. There's going to be another source for the UV part. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. Tungsten is still king as far as cheap sources. You might operate it at about 3,000. Again, inner atmosphere, which is usually argon. Nitrogen will work, but you can form nitrides. Of various metals, tungsten in this case. So argon's better. All right, you actually get nitrogen's not all that inert at high temperature. useful from 350 to 2,000 nanometers. Again, 2,000 is near infrared. We're going to go up to 600, maybe 800 in the red region. Below 350, now we showed you before, I showed you a diagram previously, there is some intensity here below 350, and I don't know where, this would be 250 here, right? So there's some intensity in that region, but the problem is that if it's inside of a glass envelope, the glass envelope, it's a bulb, right? A glass bulb. The glass absorbs some of that light. So you're not going to, there's very little intensity in the UV, and the glass envelope that you put it in absorbs that anyway. So you're really not going to use these kind of sources, a tungsten filament, below 350 nanometers where the glass absorbs. Now, a tungsten halogen lamp, still tungsten. It's tungsten halogen, though. We put a halogen in there. We put chloride in there or bromide in there inside of this light bulb. What does that do for you? At high temperature, you form halides. When you shut the light bulb off, the volatile halides condense back onto the they condense everywhere inside the filament, inside of the envelope. But some of them condense back on the filament. You heat it up again, they come off. You shut it off, they condense back on. Okay, it prolongs the life of the filament because you get this condensation effect of this material coming back onto it. What happens is you can operate a tungsten halogen at higher temperatures and get a better black body output. So now we can go another 500 degrees hotter, more intense, high flux. The function of the halide. Okay, so I already talked to you about that. You need a quartz envelope. So most in your cars today, most manufacturers make the cars now with tungsten lamps. Okay, that's what they come with from the factory. When you go to change that lamp, it's usually got a quartz envelope, and you can't get your grubby little fingers all over it. Because if you do, you put grease or oil from your fingers on that filament, it creates a hot spot, and it'll crack. Same with those halogen lamps that people buy and burn their houses down with. You know, there's big lamps that have a tungsten halogen bulb in them, and the wind blows the curtains over onto the lamp and starts it on fire, and the house burns down. Okay, it happens all the time. Very hot. Don't want to touch it with your fingers, okay? Because you'll create a hot spot that'll crack that quartz jacket. Okay. Fingerprints a problem. Car headlights. So everybody's using halogens these days, or something better. Gas discharge lamps. I could go on forever. A gas discharge lamp is another type. It's not an incandescent. There's not a filament in there. This is a gas discharge lamp right here. There's electrodes in the end, right? We have to have a transformer in there that creates a discharge to start the lamp, and then you get a discharge between the electrodes, and you get emission from the gas or the whatever the substance is inside of that lamp. In this case, there's little droplets of mercury in there. Now, why they haven't outlawed these lamps yet, the reason is because they're good. They work real well, and they consume less energy than incandescent bulbs. They're not as hot. They don't generate as much heat. So there's some advantages. So the fact that they're filled with mercury, which is everywhere and killing us, okay, neurotoxin makes you go crazy. Makes you mad as a hatter, I told you, right? So that's a discharge lamp. I guess that was my point. Two electrodes in the ends, and there's a gas inside. In this case, we're primarily concerned with mercury vapors because that's a mercury vapor lamp. Electrons collide. So the electrons from the electrodes collide with the gas molecules inside and create excitation, which then causes emission. That's how we get the light. Okay, at high pressure, if I pump this lamp up here to high pressure, then I get a smearing effect of the transitions. So when a gas molecule gets hit by an electron, it gets excited and then emits. It puts out a line that is characteristic of the transition. So it would give you a line source. But I don't want a line source. This is Roman numeral 1, continuum sources. So how do I make a source like that a continuum? I put it under high pressure. Okay, I'll bring some in next class. You put it under high pressure. As the transition is occurring, there's perturbations. Molecules are colliding with each other, and it smears out the energy. And so I get energy at a lot of wavelengths, not just the one that's characteristic of the transition. Sometimes a molecule collides with it and reduces the energy. So now I got light at a different wavelength. So by putting the system under high pressure, I generate a smearing effect which causes the spectrum to approach a continuum. So the higher the pressure, the greater probability that there'll be collisions and the smearing effect will occur. Okay. We'll talk about these next class. I'll give you plenty of examples of different things, and I'll bring some in. We'll have show and tell. And.